from the Mutual Broadcasting System. This is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT, and our Strategic Risk Assessment Talk today is going to discuss what I think has been a little bit underreported, and that has been the situation with the Russo-Ukraine war, the war in Ukraine, and what's been happening, and particularly the fact that Ukraine has been very successful stopping the much-vaunted Russian spring offensive, which really hasn't materialized at all. In fact, if anything, it's almost turned into the Ukrainian spring offensive or counteroffensive that's going on. And also the huge problems that Russia is having, you know, economically, with key sectors of its economy. And then I'm going to kind of finish off talking a little bit about some of the nefarious things Russia's done or been doing to support Iran in targeting American bases and Americans in the war in the Middle East. So anyway, let me get started. All right. Here's the big headline. Russia is far worse off militarily today than it was a year ago. That's kind of big. You may remember all the stuff that was done with President Trump meeting Putin in Alaska and all that stuff where they're talking about, oh, we're going to have this big peace thing and all these very highly publicized meetings that really didn't seem to amount to much about trying to some sort of big peace initiative, and nothing went anywhere. And basically, Russia's position has always been, hey, essentially for Ukraine, you surrender and we'll declare victory and then we'll have peace. That's I think that peace is spelled P-I-E-C-E. It's a different peace, but that's kind of what Russia was always doing. So it really wasn't anywhere to go. But what you see within Russia today is a growing chorus of voices, not just within Russia, but particularly across the Russian diaspora, influencers, others, military bloggers or mil bloggers, they call them, who do not see Russia as doing well, who do not see Russia as prevailing in this war, and are very, very critical of what Putin is doing in managing the war, for lack of a better term. Real quick, in March, Russia lost about 35,000 troops, killed and wounded, injured, wounded bad enough that they had to be medically evacuated off the battlefield. There's, and at some point, these types of monthly losses of 1,000 or more per day become unsustainable. I know it seems there's a bottomless pit of Russian troops, but at some point, and it's certainly gone on for a very long time, the mothers of Russia will weigh in and just say, look, you're not killing off my sons, my husband, you know, my father. Well, that'd be the daughters of Russia. But anyway, you know, that they're going to weigh in and say these things. And about, and Russia has surpassed 1.3 million losses during the course of war. That's just a phenomenal amount of manpower that has been lost in this meat grinder campaign that they've been running. Russian recruiting actually was reportedly doing better. They were offering huge bonuses for recruitment. They were dropping all the standards, so they were getting the number of troops out there. But now more and more stories are coming out, and unfortunately a lot of this is anecdotal, but it's coming out, that they're having a very tough time recruiting right now. Even with these big bonuses, people are looking at this saying, you know, looking more and more like a one-way ticket, it just may not be worth it trying to do this. And that deals with overall confidence in how the war is being run or how the war is being managed. Interestingly, Kim Jong-un, the hermit kingdom of North Korea, actually built a memorial for North Korean war dead that have been suffered in fighting the war against Ukraine in Russia. Now, that's interesting. Obviously, North Korea probably wouldn't want to publicize that it's losing a lot of troops, but I guess whatever it was, even within the hermit kingdom, they couldn't hide this too much more So now they're taking the next, they're changing tack, and they're basically saying, oh, let's honor them for their great sacrifice and everything else. So I just find that rather interesting. And by the way, whatever official troop losses that North Korea puts out there, you can bet you can multiply that by two or three and maybe get a lot closer to the reality of just how many people they have actually lost in that war. Now, while Russia and Ukraine had declared a ceasefire from May 9th to 11th, in order to commemorate the victory of Soviet forces in World War II over the Nazis, and this allows Putin to hold the famous Victory Day parade in Red Square in Moscow, there's something interesting. That parade had no tanks, no missiles, no real military equipment. All it had was troop formations marching by. And we had seen throughout the course of the year that each of these parades seemed to have a little bit less and less. I think last year there was like one lone T-34 World War II era tank that went through. None of the Armada 14s or anything, you know, modern weaponry, and they weren't showing off their modern ballistic missiles and all this other stuff. They were showing off old World War II stuff, and in this case, they just gave up showing off any of that stuff. The other thing was, apparently Putin was paranoid as all get out that the Ukrainians were going to target Red Square, and they had even gone so far as to tell diplomats in Kyiv that they need to evacuate the city because they're about to get bathed in Russian retaliatory missiles and drone strikes. And to the diplomats' credit, none of them did, but certainly that was what Russia did. And then this ceasefire was declared, which kind of seems to be holding a bit. You know, I'm not holding my breath on this, but seems to be kind of holding. So it's rather interesting to see that stories are abounding that, you know, and the truth is that there haven't been a lot of public appearances involving Putin. And stories are abounding that the reason why is because he's hiding. He's staying in these underground revetments. He's got his family ensconced in one of his houses in a very secured location. He has moved air defense systems to protect his homes, to protect him, and leaving other things exposed like oil refineries and stuff, which are getting hit pretty regularly by the Ukrainians. And that he is very afraid that the Ukrainians are going to assassinate him using some sort of diabolical drone strike sort of thing. Also, he is under the belief that there are forces closer to home, you know, maybe in the Kremlin and around him that are coalescing, that they're recognizing that his hold on power is not what it was, and that they want to, you know, stage a coup or something to depose him. So he's reportedly very, very paranoid that all this stuff is happening around him, and that he's very afraid of what could happen in the future. And, you know, he already had a problem of what we call an information bubble, where basically the real world is not really getting to him very well. Certainly the real world of what's going on in the war, and that there were, you know, reports that he was basically being fed deliberately mischaracterized information to look like things aren't as bad in Ukraine as they are for Russian forces. And that over time, this, you know, that time basically will wind some of this stuff out. You can only lie for so long. Eventually the truth or something close to it will eventually surface. And so this has only fed his paranoia and his problem with his information bubble even more as things become more difficult with Ukraine. And he keeps doing things that are based on false information. You kind of run into the same situation that the Germans had during the last year of World War II, that everything was going against the Germans and that Hitler was being fed all sorts of information. And at the very end, Hitler was trying to move formations of German forces on the battlefield that no longer existed. These are units, divisions, armies that had been wiped out, corps that had been, they were no longer there. And he was trying to move these forces around as if there was something there. And I'm not saying that Putin has gone that far, but I don't think Putin really has a grasp of just how dire things are for the Russian troops and the Russian units that are engaged there, which And that helps the Ukrainians. All right. Now, some other things are happening there. Some other things are really kind of interesting. Ukraine has basically been reaching out a lot of ways. I mean, the reports are that Ukraine has pretty much said, look, the Trump administration has some sort of affinity towards Russia, and that Ukraine is just really not going to get much out of them. And certainly not like it was in the previous administration, and that they went looking to Europe and went looking elsewhere. And now with the war in Iran, that they have built relationships with the Gulf states, selling them drone defense capabilities, drone defense technology, and also drone defense expertise that the Gulf states desperately needed. And so they built an entree there. The other thing I would point out is the famous FP5 Flamingo cruise missile that the Ukrainians developed, that they've been using to great effect throughout Russia. They just displayed for sale at a military conference, a military showcase in Turkey. And that's kind of interesting. That says that this missile works in their mind so well, and I think there's a lot of truth to that, that they could sell it elsewhere. And it's certainly a lot less expensive than the U.S. Tomahawk missile, and it carries a much larger warhead than the U.S. Tomahawk missile. So that's something kind of interesting to see, that how Ukraine is changing how it's doing things there. And obviously proving, and the U.S. is not going to give Ukraine Tomahawk missiles, at least that's become very clear. So they're showing that they have more than a few cards to play for themselves, so to speak. All right. Ukraine is reportedly deployed a counter-drone laser system. I've been reading about this thing, which has been in development for some time, and now they're saying they're at the threshold of getting ready to field deploy this thing all over the place. I'm going to watch and see what happens, but I'm cautiously optimistic. They've had plenty of time to battlefield test this thing. No shortage of drone targets to practice on in Ukraine. And if it does what they hope, you know, right now you fire a counter-drone drone interceptor, costs, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to build, and you take out a $35,000 Shahed drone. Okay, so, you know, it's a kind of rough parity, maybe a little cheaper to build the interceptor than to build the drone, but, you know, rough parity. That's opposed to using a Patriot missile to take out a Shahed drone, where you got a missile that costs millions of dollars to take out a $35,000 drone, and that is not a cost-effective air defense solution. And then you have this laser system, which literally is a few dollars to shoot a laser beam to take out a system. And if it works, it could be very effective. And I don't say it's going to take out every threat that they see, but it could take out a plethora, which means a lot to me, a plethora of drone threats that are coming into these cities. And that could change the threat dynamic of what the Russians pose. And it could change actually warfare for what drones pose across the spectrum as well. So that's something that they are putting out there, all right? Also, Ukrainian drones are increasingly striking, you know, deep behind the front lines, and this is in the context of the war in Ukraine. The Institute for the Study of War has been talking about how important a factor they become within the Ukrainian counteroffensive. The Ukrainians are talking about building this 15-kilometer defensive zone, which is basically controlled by drones. Air, ground. In fact, the Ukrainians not too long ago did a combined air and ground drone attack that took a Russian position. You actually had Russian soldiers surrendering to robotic ground drones, to give you an idea of what's going on. But the idea is that you create this 15-kilometer wide no man's land, if you will, where any type of Russian offensive thing, whether it's using vehicles or armored systems or whatever, would be defeated by drones in this zone. So it's a fascinating concept, but you are seeing where Russians are doing some deep strikes up to 100 kilometers behind the front lines, and they're taking out those Russian logistics units, those Russian force service support capability. Relatively risk-free, certainly risk-free from the, you know, in terms of putting Ukrainian troops at risk. And they're achieving some very significant effects on the battlefield, all right? degrading Russian forces' ability to conduct future offensive operations, and also enabling defending Ukrainian counterattacks. And so, since mid-April, Ukraine has done a lot of things. Beyond that, they've been attacking deep into the Russian deep into their strikes, like thousands of kilometers, thousand or more kilometers, 1,500 kilometers, longer than that, into Russia, going up all the way up to the near the Baltic, near St. Petersburg, up to the Ural Mountains. They hit the Tuops oil terminal in Russia's Black Sea coast four times. Apparently have caused massive devastation to that. And when they hit these oil terminals, that blocks Russia's ability to export oil. And Russia's oil export revenues have dropped 40%. That may be an understatement. It could be dropped by half of what it previously was before Ukraine was able to start taking out all these Russian oil and oil refinery capabilities. So that is a huge difference. And it raises a question. If Russia maintains one of the largest air defense networks in the world, how are Ukrainian drones able to reach the same facility time and time again? You know, you would think if they hit it once, hit it twice, that they would be able to do something. Obviously, the Russians can't manifest a way to successfully defend this type of critical infrastructure from Ukrainian drone attacks. And that says that they're having a tough time defending this oil infrastructure against sustained long-range drone campaign that the Ukrainians are putting forward. Ukraine's strategy relies on simply attritional warfare, sustained pressure, where a handful of drones going in there can eventually penetrate those defenses, cause major disruption, particularly when you have a highly flammable facility like that. And it's estimated that it's causing tremendous problems, not just the loss of oil revenue from exports, but huge gas lines, shortage of gasoline in the country. They've had to divert oil exports to domestic consumption simply because they're so short of oil across the board. And certainly it was predicted that the Russians were going to experience an economic windfall from having the sanctions temporarily lifted and being able to export oil at a greater rate while Iran was essentially taken offline. And that bounty has not really manifested itself, certainly in the way that Russia hoped it would, simply because of these very successful deep strikes. There's sources that have talked about that the Caspian Sea is increasingly becoming a conduit for Russian, Iranian back and forth trade, particularly Russia's Iran with weapon systems and things that they need. And what's key about that is that the Iranians and their deep strike capabilities have actually been taken out. Russia have actually, including ships, have taken out Russian targets. In fact, they just took out a Russian warship in the Caspian not too long ago. Now, there's a report out there that the Wall Street Journal had that the GRU, the Russian Military Intelligence Directorate, has a plan. It's not quite sure where it is, if it's in process or coming soon, that they want to send 5,000 first-person view FPV battlefield drones, fiber optic, and if they're fiber optic controlled, that means that electronic warfare can't jam the signal because there's no signal out there for them to jam. And that these would be used for a variety of things. Now, one of the things it mentioned was they showed a video, was apparently to the Iranians, that showed these drones, or these FPV drones, being used to counter an amphibious assault. That seems to be aimed directly at U.S. Marines, possibly doing an amphibious raid or something in the Persian Gulf, or maybe one of the Strait of Hormuz Islands or something like that. So I found that kind of interesting. Also, there's reports of larger drones, fixed wing, that fly further, that would be controlled through satellite communications. So that's out there. And you may recall that earlier, weeks ago, there was reports that the Russians were providing high-grade satellite intelligence that that showing exact locations of American forces, American assets, American personnel that the Iranians were using for targeting purposes as well. So that says a lot about what the Russians are doing, working with Iran, basically to kill Americans and destroy American bases, facilities, equipment, everything else, very much there. So there is a lot going on with the war in Ukraine, and it does not bode well for the Russians. And that is the big story from this spring that has been largely underreported that I want to talk about. And also, the Russians are very actively engaged trying to help Iranians kill Americans in the Middle East. And politically, not just militarily, but politically, one wonders where that will eventually go. I don't see the body politic in the U.S. Dealing with that. You know, even though everything else is going on and this is not the most reported story, just politically, I just see that as something that's going to make it very difficult to give any sort of special consideration or whatever to Russia. I just see that it's going to really harden some positions as to we've really got to support Ukraine and that Russia has to be decisively defeated on the battlefield because they're not just attacking Ukrainians, they're deliberately attacking Americans as we're doing things in other parts of the world. Hey, thanks for listening to Strat. Please visit stratpodcast.com. You go to my YouTube channel at Hal Kempfert TV. You can also go to my website at www.gripsa.com. And also go to the www.infraguardlosangeles.org website. I have a global threat update coming up in early June that I'm doing for InfraGuard. And also you can do the encore of the Gray Zone Threats webinar that I did before. If you didn't have a chance to see that and you are concerned about some of these hybrid warfare or gray zone threats, whether it's Russia, China, or other countries around the world, I hope you have the time that you can sit down and maybe get a thorough brief on what that's all about. So anyway, thanks, and hopefully I'll have a chance to talk to you at the next Strat.